Hello and welcome to Wax Lyrical, the advertising and marketing podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. And I'm Mark.
I'm Dave.
I'm Karen.
And I'm Paul.
And in this episode, we'll be taking a closer look at the realities of creating a direct-to-consumer business. And do wacky ads really work? Plus new campaigns from Starbucks, British Gas and Marks and Spencers.
Great.
If you've listened to the podcast before, you'll know that we talk about direct-to-consumer quite a bit. And in the last episode, we, with our tongues in our cheek, responded to an article in Marketing Week that Mark Ritson had written, where I think he'd been a bit unkind about the direct-to-consumer thing.
It was a bit of a bashing, yeah.
It was, saying, oh, you know, they're kind of all cool guys in white shirts from Harvard who just come up with a crazy idea in the kitchen and they don't have to make any money. They just take loads of millions of pounds of private equity money and kind of blow it, don't they? He didn't say that, but there was that
good summary
there was that hint there. And so how delightful it is to have one of those white shirted Harvard guys.
can't believe you stole my founder story. Yes. How did you know?
in the office with us today, welcome Dave.
Thank you.
You set up the London Sock Company.
Yeah, me and my co-founder. We were just talking earlier, what, 6 years almost to the day since we launched.
We must say Dave is wearing a green t-shirt this morning.
He's
as well.
He's not a white shirt.
No
white
listeners yet. And purple socks, I have to point that out.
Can I just share how I came to know about you? So again, if you've listened to the podcast, you'll know that last year we did a live episode of the podcast from up in the Gherkin, I think.
Top was of the Gherkin, yeah.
Yeah, which was
good
a weird experience to record the podcast
in
up.
In the cafe restaurant area the top.
In the kind of globey bit at the top that you're open to the kind of in front of an audience, and it was about direct to consumer stuff. And I just happened to say genuinely that one of my favourite direct to consumer brands is this sock subscription service, and I had me socks on at the time, and so me being me on stage, I kind of took my shoes off and showed everybody my socks. And Dave, two of your colleagues, of course, were in the audience, and they came up to me afterwards and said, oh, that's really nice of you, thank you. I said, no, it's fine. And then we kind of got to know each other, and you're here, so welcome.
It's fantastic to be here, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming in. Yeah, it's great to have you here.
Well, let's start with one of those things that Mr. Ritson said, and he accuses you and your colleagues of kind of setting out to disrupt a category. I mean, what were the first thoughts on your mind when you thought, oh, I know what, I'll start selling socks?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I think the reality was we were in the city and we were recognising that a lot of guys were dressing less formally. In the 90s or even 80s, you might have chosen a tie to wear that day if you had a particular interview or a pitch, and you'd maybe think about the colour or the pattern. That doesn't happen anymore. Sales of ties have really fallen off of a cliff, and we felt that maybe there's an opportunity. You're still going to want to dress more smartly to work, but not as formally. And our socks a great way to add a bit of personality, a bit of colour in the workplace. So for us, it was more sensing that most guys haven't really thought about this as an accessory. We don't really have it in our arsenal, so to speak, of what to wear to work. And it was more just, can we make something of this? Can we show guys that this is something they can wear? Particularly in the workplace was where we, you know, were primarily focused, and take it from there. So it wasn't necessarily about disruption. We were aware that there were businesses that have sold socks for many years, possibly centuries, and I think we knew that it was an old category. But then that was part of the appeal. It's a product that we do wear every day, and we felt that there's a nice simplicity there, that it's something that if you can create a brand and bring that in a more convenient way to customers, it felt like there was something there. And the more we looked at it, the more we looked at, you know, you can obsess about data, reports, market insights, but fundamentally just we ran out of reasons not to try it and not to give it a go.
How much of a wrench was it from the job that you'd thought you were going to be doing to kind of this, it sounds like a crazy world of, you know, an all-encompassing obsession with getting the right product, the right kind of distribution and all that kind of stuff, the right experience, yeah.
Yeah, I was talking to someone a couple of years ago, and I tried to explain the moment where I was explaining to my now 97-year-old granny that I was leaving a really successful career job in the city to sell
Accenture,
socks.
Didn't you?
That's right.
Yeah.
And you know, I think rightly she was a bit confused. Like, I think it was in some senses it was I wouldn't really describe it as a wrench. I think for us, Ryan and I had both had startup experiences before we got to Accenture, and just wanted to get out and experience something again. And thankfully, the two of us had become close friends and were, you know, really enjoying the process of talking through different business ideas, and, you know, of which SOX was one that we kept coming back to. So it just felt like the right timing for us. We didn't have a huge amount of responsibility. We were just turning sort of 30, early 30s. It just felt like a good time to give it a go. Mm. And what's the worst that can happen, right? You can always go back and pick up your career somewhere, maybe having learned a few more things along the way.
You'll work for EY or Deloitte, yeah?
Just shop around, yeah. So most of my friends have done, but they've earned a lot more money than I have, so.
You can't think about that, but yeah. Was the subscription part always baked in from the beginning? Because you're the insight of the declining ties, I suppose you probably never could have predicted how men's fashion would have changed over even the last 5 years, I suppose, the way men's fashion has become much more democratized. But was the subscription part always baked in from the beginning?
We really liked it. One of the inspirations that we had back in 2012, I was working in the sort of consumer goods area, and I remember when Dollar Shave Club launched, and Gillette was one of Accenture's clients, I think, in the US. And I know that sent shockwaves around that industry, thinking that, oh, you know, we've kind of had it our own way for a long time, and this could really change things. And I think there was something in that for not just for men, but for busy professionals. That is there a way to, once you're happy with something, you like the product, you like the experience, can you just switch on a convenient service that allows it to be delivered more regularly and you don't have to think about it? And we really liked it. It's not all that we do. It's about, I think, about 15% of our revenue is recurring, pay monthly, subscription or quarterly. Most people, you know, enjoy buying as they need, so it's not necessarily it's not all we do, but I just thought it was interesting. We thought it was something new, a bit innovative. I think we were the first to do it in the UK, certainly. It's been a good talking point. I think it's helped get the message out, and it's helped give people a bit more interest or reason to check us out.
We talked about it at the Gherkin podcast. We talked about was largely about subscription models, and it's kind of just the categories that are now moving to subscription models is just kind of unprecedented, and it is fascinating. It started out as kind of quite straightforward things, and now, as you said, you've got things that you'd only ever buy in the supermarket, or things you'd only ever go to like the high street to get, and now through subscription. So it's, again, I guess that's another thing of very good timing for you to kind of be at the front when that started to really, really take off. But from a personal note, I completely concur. Like, the sock as an accessory, definitely, like, I completely agree. With a wardrobe that's predominantly navy or black, it's quite nice to think about like adding a bit of colour through your sock. So I think that insight is bang on.
And I was speaking at an event the other day, which was about personalization. And yet again, the London Sock Company came to my mind, because how I knew about you was that I'd been given a gift subscription. And genuine, I'm not saying this just because you were here. The experience, the best bit was getting the email just before that month's socks were due to arrive. And it would say, hey, we've got these for you, but would you like to change the ones that we've selected for you? So there's a bit of kind of suggestion thing, a bit like a Netflix thing, saying we think you'd like these, but you can at the last stage customize or personalize whichever way you want it. And so you were much more engaged, thinking, oh yeah, I was going to have the pink ones, but now maybe I'll have the kind of tartany ones. and then, you know, a week later they turn up, and that's amazing. And it's so the whole experience is really nice. It's got CRM inbuilt into the whole thing. It's really clever, you know.
I find that really interesting, actually, because I love your story. I think it's amazing, because I think in the Ritson article, not to keep banging on about it, but
let's do it.
Mark's going to hate us, isn't he?
I know. I hope he's not listening.
He's going to have to come back and kind of have the right of reply after all this.
I'm just scared of what's going to come out on his Twitter. He's going to say something really mean.
Not sure he's going to worry too much about us.
No, probably, yeah. But there's an implication in the article that, my reading of it is that some D2C businesses do disruption for disruption's sake, but I think that doesn't actually, that does a bit of a disservice to what you were trying to do, because you're actually trying to meet a real consumer need, or you've identified a niche in the market, you've identified trends in the market, and you've tried to shape something around that. And I think then it becomes about the customer experience, because you there's a real niche there that you know you've got something that will meet a customer need. So it would be interesting to know more about how you shaped the customer experience, or what inspiration you had around that.
It's a really good point, and I think the reality was we knew what we wanted to achieve in terms of creating a brand for men to help them express themselves in the workplace, but actually trying to figure out what is it that's going to resonate best with them, and how are they going to enjoy the product and the experience, we sort of had to do that through testing. And we even used we had a stall in Leadenhall Market actually in our first few months of trading, just behind the offices that we used to work in, and that was a great sort of learning ground to have. I mean, sure, we didn't want to be spending our days running a stall in a market around there, but actually a great way to have city workers who were just walking by on their lunch break and give you invaluable feedback, and also you'd get to know the faces. We did it for about 18 months actually in the end, and it'd be the same guys coming back every other month, every kind of 6 weeks or so, like, oh yeah, great, love those socks, I'm coming back for more of those colours. And so you got real good insights into the buying behaviour, what they were most interested in. And I think you know you talk about D2C and kind of disruption, and I think what investors want is this sort of silver bullet online business that's going to scale to be $1 billion, and it's something that no one else can do. But I think the reality is there are ways to build a relationship with customer and get insight. And look, I mean, even the subscription platform, like, there is so many things that we want to improve around that, and we've just, you know, we've had to focus our limited resources on partly keeping the lights on, partly, you know, our business has grown I think 5 times in the last 3 years, so like, wow, it's just trying to sustain that sort of growth and keep everyone focused and hire the team, and it's hard. So I think knowing that there are, you know, you've such lovely feedback that you're having a great experience already, we look at it and go, oh my god, like, we need to fix so many things, and so many customers have given us great feedback on things they'd like to see better. And you know, we developed that platform from scratch. We couldn't find anything in the market that would help our customer have that sort of personalized experience. That was really important to us. And so we had a meeting last night actually, just with some of the priorities for this year that we can try and improve on that and make it better.
I suppose that'll that feeling will never go, you know, kind of want to do things better and really push it, which is kind of a key to success. Did some of your old colleagues used to come past you when you were stood on your I can imagine that was probably quite a nice moment to be like, hey, yeah.
Well, I don't know, I mean, I think it was a little bit like, you know, they look at you, like, so you've left your job to stand here in a cold sort of November morning and selling some socks
What's
in a market stall, you know.
But he's a really clever bloke. He used to work at Accenture, now he's on a market stall
selling socks.
That doesn't kind of work, does it?
I think definitely in the last like 2 or 3 years, it's been nice. Like, people have, some guys have been really honest, like, you know, and just told me, like, I really, when you told me you were going to go do this, I thought you were nuts. I just didn't see it.
I can imagine.
But now I really get it, and I'm so, you know, well done. That you guys have done a great job, and that's lovely to see and hear. And but you know, who cares? You've got to do these things, right? You've got to go and stand in a market stall in a cold winter morning.
Absolutely, yeah. I can relate to that look, kind of, which makes sense after a few years when you're like, people, when you say you're going to start your own business, they're like, oh, that's brave, and you're like, no, you're just so enthusiastic. You're like, it'd be absolutely fine. And then a few years later, you're like, okay, I know why people used to look at me like that, because it can be tough. But I guess you do it because you believe it'd be worth it. You know, it's important. You want to do your own thing, so it's great. We've talked about the positives. What's been the hardest part, would you say?
It's all hard. It really is. And I've come to use this phrase in the office, and the guys will be laughing if they hear, but I talk about it being reassuringly hard. It is just every single year, every single step is tough. And there's a lot of focus on some of the success stories that you might hear in the startup world, from the US in particular, where, you know, they've launched something and they've done $1 million in sales in their first week, and it's all just been so easy and they've scaled. I just, having met a number of founders now, no one has that story. Yeah. I just don't think it exists. It is tough. So scaling quickly has been really hard. Raising investment has been tougher over the last kind of couple of years. But thankfully we've got really supportive investors that have helped us, otherwise we could never have scaled that quickly and managed that. And yeah, like, just getting the right getting the right team and being able to hire and attract the right sort of talent and get the right culture and all these things that when it's just you and your co-founder in a kitchen, it doesn't, you know, you don't think about these things. And then as you grow, actually, you know, you've got really talented individuals that are giving up most of their waking time to come and help build this business with you and for you. And you know, you've got to really think about how you can make it as exciting for them as it is for you. The reality is, you're a founder, it's always going to be different, but what can you do to try and make it better for them and as good as it can be? So yeah, all those things just become more of a focus and more of a challenge. And yeah, I mean, ask me again tomorrow. There'll be specifics and really tough things.
Reassuringly hard, yeah, I like that. I think one thing I did agree with what Ritson said was that many of the startups you just, or the DTC brands you just don't see, and that is a reality, as you said, whether they've got not quite got the right idea, or as you said, they haven't quite solved the scaling challenge that is inevitable for those that do find success. So that is a reality that kind of you don't see them all. But I think my point of view remains, which is like, we should be grateful they're giving it a go because it stimulates the economy. And whilst they're not always going to be successful, it gives, I suppose, for you, you're not just, we obviously have an advertising skew, but you've got supply chain and materials and stuff like that. So by your efforts alone, you are stimulating many, many different economies. So that on a bigger scale is what I think what Britain needs.
Another one of Ritson's accusations was that D2C community isn't that focused on making a profit. And I've been listening to you for the past few minutes, and I can't believe that's not on your mind from what you've said.
No, I absolutely. I mean, I think the reality is, it is tough to grow a business from scratch. And I mean, our entire sort of investment structure in the UK in particular, there's some amazing opportunities for high net worth to invest in startups, and there's tax benefits for doing so that the government have supported that for years. And it's amazing, actually, because it drives so much investment behavior into early stage startups that are high risk, and without it, I think you would struggle. But one of the proponents of that is that, you know, there's no incentive for them. They can't take dividends out of the business. It's designed so that every bit of investment goes in to help you scale the business, and you should be trying to reinvest whatever profits you make to continue to scale. So there's no, I think there's a recognition that in the early part of growing a business, you can't be focused on being profitable and scaling. And you recognize that as a startup, there's a runway that you're on. Like, you've got momentum, you've got opportunity. Other people are going to try and take some of that opportunity once you pave away. And so you need to be as ambitious and aggressive as you can. And I think there is a balance. I think, you know, again, I don't want to point fingers necessarily at the US, but I know that there are startups getting checks written for
silly money,
crazy funds. And of course, like, you give give entrepreneurs $100 million check when you launch Harry's razor brand, like, of course they're going to spend it, right? They're going to go and hire really great people and build a brand, and they've had a fantastic journey. I think that's one story out of probably a graveyard of many failures. And I think, yeah, it's just not how it works in the UK, certainly. Investors are a little bit more, I think, practical and pragmatic around how you scale your business. And yeah, we're just trying to do it what feels instinctively the right way to do it, and that is being as ambitious but also sensible with our growth as we can.
And the kind of obvious questions, forgive me, are what's next then? So you're 6 years in. How do you see the next 3 to 4 years?
Do you know, it's so hard to say. I mean, every year is so different. Certainly this year, we've got such an exciting opportunity to focus still in the UK market. We saw, you know, great growth last year, and there's still a lot of professional men and women who are buying from men in this area, particularly even around London, that we've just not managed to reach yet and haven't heard of us. So we're very much focused on just continuing to do what we do. We're looking at adding new categories, new products that fit the lifestyle of our customer. And one of our fastest growth markets has been the US, actually. And so just, it's now about 40% of our sales are coming from our US customer. Primarily New York, a little bit of LA, a little bit sort of Houston, Texas, those areas. So the sort of business hubs around the country. I mean, we're still based in London. We don't have any operations out there. We're just shipping product direct to them from our fulfillment center here. But you know, you've got to start thinking about how can you capitalize on that opportunity without investing too much and taking too much risk. But there's a real opportunity there. So yeah, like certainly in the immediate future, it's not too much change, not too much distraction, just trying to focus on doing what we're doing well and add a bit more complexity and just follow the money, I guess. Follow the opportunity. That's all we can do.
You said just do it. What have you got to lose? But for anybody who's in their marketing manager job and a bit, you know, there's an itch they want to scratch and they think they've got an idea, what advice would you give to somebody who's maybe thinking of doing that startup on their own?
Do as much of the groundwork as you can before you leave your job. And I think, you know, Ryan and I were very lucky that we were able to use empty offices after 6 o'clock in the Accenture building. And, you know, probably shouldn't be telling Accenture this in case it goes, but, you know, you're like using whiteboards and just trying to, and then we would maybe once, twice a week, we would have those regular catch ups. And so by the time we were leaving, we had a reasonably qualified business idea that we were going to go and do. We were also fortunate that Accenture offered a sort of leave of absence option, which was for a variety of things. You know, if you wanted to leave and take a year out and go traveling, or you just got married and you wanted to do whatever, like, but one of the things that you could do in that was that you could go and start a business as long as it wasn't going to compete with Accenture. And so
Sox was a good choice.
Yeah,
yeah, I'm sure they're not going to get into that yet. So that, I think there are things that maybe if you have an honest conversation with your employer and your manager, like most people recognize that, okay, you're not going to compete with me, you're going to go and start something. If it doesn't work out, why wouldn't I want to bring you back into my company again? Because you're going to have learned, you know, so much more by the time you come back.
Joking about Accenture, they might even want to invest.
You never know.
So you can imagine somebody who's in a marketing job now and they say, I've got a great idea for a completely different product. It's but all the stuff I've learned, your CEO might go, well, you know, here's 50 grand. I'll have some startup and take me, what is it, EIS?
That's right.
Tax relief they'll get as a result of it.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I mean, we've got a couple of investors that are ex-Accenture, sort of quite senior managing director positions that we knew while we were there. And as soon as we left, they were like, yeah, I like the sound of that, I'm going to put some money in. So
brilliant.
I think the only other thing is just try and think about why you want to do it would be the only other bit of advice. I think it's tough, and you've got, you know, you're going to either not earn any money or certainly earn very little money, and so you've got an opportunity cost to consider, and is it really what you want to do, and are you doing it for the right reasons? Because it's certainly not the easy choice at all.
There's plenty of evidence that the D2C brands that get true scale do end up back in bricks and mortar, or not back, but they end up going into bricks and mortar, call it Harry's, for example. Do you ever envision that happening for you guys as a because there's a hypothesis that in the current climate, the only way to get true mass market is to go into bricks and mortar. So whether your socks ended up in Waitrose, or sorry, like John Lewis, for example. Mm. Did you ever see that happening, or that you kind of principled that will only ever be online?
Yeah, well, interestingly, we learned quite early on that there was an opportunity. We had, just once we started on Instagram, there was a couple of tailors actually around West London had messaged and said, do you guys do wholesale? Of course, you have to Google what's wholesale. we knew nothing about this industry, right? So we're like, okay, let's. I went down, met with one of them, and who became a long-term customer, just placing relatively small orders. But like, you know, he was a tiny little store and he was spending like a good £1,000 on an order now and again. You're like, actually, there's something in this. It takes a bit of my time to go down. The next Monday, I went up and down Savile Row with a box of socks and was like, you know, is anyone interested in stocking our brand? And actually got a couple of opportunities from that as well. And so straight away, we sort of balanced our online with more traditional wholesale, which it wasn't what we set out to do on day one, but we sort of fell into it within the first couple of months. And for the last 3 years, we've been selling in Fortnum and Mason in their menswear floor, and we've been their top selling sock brand. In fact, top two or three of overall menswear sales, which is nuts. We just launched in Harrods just before Christmas, and that's gone incredibly well. So they want to keep us in there through this year. Mr. Porter is one of the big online retailers that we're stocked in and do very well in. And I think because of those retailers, that brings more opportunity as well. So yeah, for us, it's a balance. I think we've always recognised that 80% of retail sales are in store. even now. And although that dial is shifting, like, there's still a great opportunity to let people touch and feel your product and experience the brand.
I agree. I think there needs to be like a new category, which is mostly direct to consumer, you know, kind of MD2C, because I think that's the current reality for success. So it's good to hear you doing it.
Yeah. My question was, because we work in advertising, we spend a lot of time thinking about the brand. And I was wondering what kind of focus you placed on brand in terms of how you present yourselves, how you talk about yourselves versus the actual service. Because I would imagine it must skew towards service, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah, that's a really good question. We didn't have, disclaimer, we didn't have a background in marketing, branding, I mean, anything that would have been useful, right? We were just, we just had the idea we wanted to go do it. And I think, but we did have a strong kind of emotional feeling of how the brand should communicate. And we wanted it to feel like, sort of have a bit of a feeling of prestige that maybe it had been around for more than it had, because we felt like part of your challenge with D2C is that are people going to be confident in testing out this new experience. So we thought about how it would be presented in that point of view, and then we thought about how we wanted to communicate, and we wanted it to be sort of feel like a, you know, a more gentlemanly tone, something that was respectable, and you know, just little things like we imagined what would our face be, or who would we be if we were a person. And you want to be the kind of person that's holding the door open for someone, or, you know, just those kind of little things. So just, we tried to think about what's the character of who we would be if we were a person. And thankfully, quite early on, we had the opportunity to meet David Gandy, and he became our first investor.
How amazing.
And sort of brand ambassador. So just was, you know, he's become a really close friend, and we meet regularly to get his advice and thoughts on things and just have a good laugh. But he was the perfect sort of spokesperson, and you think you look at how he presents himself in the media, and just is always so gentlemanly and comes across so well, and that was great for us. I think that sort of maybe helped boost our sort of brand persona in ways that we just didn't have the, you know, the know-how and how to do. But yeah, amazingly now we've managed to hire just recently a very talented chief marketing officer who, I mean, she's only just getting to grips with things, but that's, you start to recognize, you know, one of the first questions she had is around, right, what is this brand, and how are we positioning it, and how are we communicating? And most of that stuff was in Ryan and I's heads, and it had been things we've been doing over the years, but just bringing that structure and just seeing someone that really knows what they're doing, helping you to refine and focus on what you're doing going forwards.
Yeah, I like that it started quite organically though, that it was just, there was always a sense of what the brand felt like. That's quite nice.
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, what else can you do? I guess that you just have to follow what's in your in your head, and that's, at the end of the day, that's what makes you unique. It's what you bring to it, what your ideas are. That's hard for other people to copy.
Definitely. Yeah.
So the other day, I was sitting chatting to Ben, who's not here today, who's our creative director, and he sent me a link to a new campaign from McDonald's. And he said, this is amazing. This is absolutely amazing. It's so cool. And obviously, as this is audio, I can't show you the ad, but Paul, could you describe these McDonald's ads for us, please?
I'll do my best. Yeah. So I think the beauty is the simplicity, and it won't take me too long to describe. Imagine a PowerPoint slide with a block colour background.
Yeah, I'm there.
And then the ingredients of particular food, call it a burger, is listed, and the kind of the words are kind of loosely coloured to what you'd expect.
Can you read food. One? You've got one in front of you, haven't
so this
you?
Is probably the longest one. Bun, beef, gherkin, lettuce, sauce, bun, beef, cheese, lettuce, sauce, bun.
Are there four buns in a burger?
In this one?
I mean, it's a Big Mac, isn't it?
It's really?
I think
it's got the middle layer, hasn't it?
I only said bun three times.
It's three buns. It's got
three buns.
A middle one.
Well, I learned something now. I mean, obviously, it's a long time since I've been to McDonald's, obviously, since Veganuary. But, okay.
So it's an interesting one. Yeah, it's very, I don't think I've ever seen McDonald's do anything like this. There's no branding on it, just to be clear. Like, it's just very much, it literally looks like a PowerPoint slide, but quite nice art direction. I don't mean to do it too much of a disservice, but yeah, it feels like they're just trying something different. I think I guess the jury's out on whether it'll work, but it feels like those in the industry will be like, that's cool.
Well, this is what Ben said. He said, oh, this is really cool. And then I, you know, went to my GCSE in planning and thought, okay, I'm not so sure about that, because there's no brand on there whatsoever. Now, I can think of a campaign that's done something similar, which was last year, and it was for Doritos. And Doritos did a completely unbranded campaign, film, everything, but using the iconic triangle of the Doritos snacky thing. What is it? A crisp. I don't know what you call it.
Yeah, it's a crisp.
It's a crisp. Just boil it down. And that triangle is unmistakably associated with the Doritos brand.
A distinctive asset.
Oh, God, you're better at this than I am. You should do my job. And so I could understand that the consumer would see the distinctive asset and the engagement to go, yeah, that's really cool. But there was no memory association, I don't think.
I don't know. Like, they're such a massive brand that kind of, like, the world knows kind of... I don't know. I feel like there it is distinctive in the certainly for like the Big Mac, there's an Egg McMuffin one that like that is distinctive.
Does it say McMuffin on it?
Doesn't say muck. Just says egg. Egg and muffin. See, I think Karen, I'll come to you. I think there's a few textbook marketing errors in this, but is that bad?
Well, it is. It's definitely gets your attention. You were saying the same thing, weren't you? That it gets your attention. So in that way, it has impact. But I feel like I would be interested to know what the strategy here was. I suspect it was to maybe be a bit disruptive. But it feels like the strategy is a bit when you know, you know. And that is not necessarily good advertising, because if you go back to the kind of basics of Byron Sharp marketing theory, then it's not so much about talking to the people that already know about you or already recognize you. That's not going to grow anything for you. What it needs to be about is getting new
reach,
people to know about you.
Yeah.
And I'm just not sure that is recognizable. And if we talk about salience being the critical thing that you can have to get someone to convert to buying your product, I don't know if that is going to do salience, because it doesn't have any distinctive assets. I'm being a bit boring about it.
McDonald's challenge is a frequency one more than like getting new people in, I think, which is like those that have a McDonald's every fortnight, will this bring them in?
Well, like, I have to say, I don't know about the fast food category, but Byron Sharp, etc., et al.'s theory is that it's never about frequency, that you will never actually be able to reach huge scale through just focusing on frequency. It has to be about growing your audience.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Dave.
I think I side with your man Ben on this. I actually really like it. I like it because it's different, and there's probably not a great deal of theory. I certainly don't have the experience behind me to have reason to be able to comment authoritatively on it. But I think that there's something lovely about the simplicity, and you're just focusing on the simple ingredients that go into a particular really popular bun that McDonald's do. So anyone that knows McDonald's will recognise that. I think there's something even in the colour palette that you just it kind of has that McDonald's feel of how their restaurants are designed now. Yeah, why not? Like, they don't need to have the golden arches on things now. They're quite an established brand. So if you're in their position,
that's true.
I'm sure it caused a bit of like conversation at the top when they were deciding whether to do it. But yeah, like, why not be a bit bold and try something different?
Yeah, I think it will be a test. Probably we'll see it in a few places, and it might be back to the Doritos point. It might be part of something bigger. You know, we may see it on TV or something, you know, that kind of fits into something else. Or it might be in their stores. We don't know. I think it'd be good if it is part of something else.
It might be that it is distinctive enough because McDonald's have got enough space in culture for it to work. Maybe. The other thing I would say about it, again, sorry, I'm just being boring, but it's not delicious. I don't, maybe
it's quite functional, you're right.
Yeah.
Yes, that is quite an interesting point of view.
I don't eat McDonald's, so maybe I'm not the best person
maybe
to judge.
Delicious isn't important for a McDonald's, is that what you were going to say?
No. What I was going to say is maybe seeing those ingredients is enough to trigger, oh, I really fancy a Big Mac. I don't know, but it doesn't really do food appeal.
Well, as usual, if anybody from McDonald's is listening, or anybody from Leo Burnett, and we actually know a few folk from Leo Burnett, don't we? So I should message them and say, please tell us, is it working?
Well, if you measure the agency, they'll definitely say yes.
But as you guys know, I thought we'd get a definitive answer on do wacky ads work. So earlier I spoke to behavioural scientist Patrick Fagan to get his point of view.
So if you see the billboard, you're going to be like, why are there only words? What brand is this? And so it's going to use that what's called a generation effect, so to get people to think about McDonald's in their own heads and to, for example, visualize and think about a Big Mac rather than an advert with just an image of a Big Mac where the processing is a lot more superficial. So in that sense, I think it's good. And there's a metaphor as well, I suppose, of the Big Mac being simple and there not being any surprises in there. It's just a very simple list of pure ingredients put together. On the other hand, I don't know if anyone's going to even look at it or pay attention to it, really, in the first place, or if people are going to engage that kind of reflective thinking that's required to solve the riddle of this metaphor and to think about the Big Mac for themselves. There's nothing really to grab people's attention. It's just text. There's no, you know, faces or puppies or anything like that, or even food. Pictures of food grab attention too. So I worry that it will just be neglected by most people driving to work, thinking about other things, not really paying attention to the billboards around them. Also, it doesn't have distinctive assets. It doesn't have McDonald's branding in it. So there's a really wasted opportunity to kind of refresh those memory networks and get people thinking about McDonald's. It's a bit like when Coca-Cola introduced Coke Life. It came in a green bottle, and Coca-Cola was basically throwing away all of the decades or a century even of branding with the colour red.
Whilst we're chatting, tell me a bit more about the basic science behind advertising.
So advertising ultimately is about building mental availability and making the brand more front of mind, because that will influence behaviour accordingly. So there's all sorts of research showing that basically if you put something in people's heads, then that will change how they behave. So one study showed people pictures which had a very subtly placed bottle of Dasani water in the pictures, which people survey questions afterwards showed that people didn't explicitly see the bottles, but it did influence their choice after the experiment. So the more of these images they were exposed to, the more likely they'd be to choose Dasani when they were offered a free bottle of water. So that's what advertising should do, basically. And so to get the brand in people's heads, first of all, the message needs to be noticed. It needs to grab people's attention. And people have very limited attention span, so you probably know about that famous video with the gorilla walking across the screen while there's two teams of people throwing the ball to each other, and about half of the people watching tend to miss the gorilla. Another study found that if you ask people to walk around a park, half of the people roughly will fail to notice a clown riding a unicycle. So there's a huge amount of information that we don't have the brain power to pay attention to. The flip side of that is that there are certain things we will immediately pay attention to because we're kind of hardwired to. So like I said, puppies or kittens or anything cute, because we have that biological need to kind of look after our young. Food obviously is about survival, sex as well, we'll pay attention to, faces, all these kind of things we'll instantly look at. So once you've got people's attention, then you want them to actually take on board the message. So rather than superficially not really absorb it, but to actually think about it and to think about it themselves. And that's where things like stories come in, because stories get people to actually feel the message rather than just think about it, and gets them to actually experience it. Metaphors or riddles or puzzles get people, and creativity, get people to kind of pay attention to what you're saying in order to figure out what it means. And fluency is also good, so being simple and concrete, so being about real visual things rather than kind of abstract concepts. And then finally, the message needs to be framed in a way that's going to actually influence behavior. So this is where your classic social proof or scarcity and things like that come in to make the desired behavior more likely to happen.
Time now to take a look at some new work. And forgive me if I intro the first one myself. I was lucky enough to be asked to judge the Channel 4 Diversity Awards last year. And the basic principle is that every year Channel 4 offer £1 million of airtime to an advertiser who pitches the best idea for a part of the community that isn't normally well represented on television in terms of advertising. And last year's focus was the LGBTQ community, and I'm not supposed to talk too much about who pitched and what worked, but you guys know I came back and I said, oh my god, I've spent a really interesting afternoon, because as a gay man I so seldom see so much work that is focused at me, if you like. And I'd spent an entire afternoon watching and listening to people who wanted to create advertising that was about me or that reflected me. Mm. And it was quite an emotional experience, because, and I'm not getting on a soapbox, well I kind of am, aren't I? but you know, when you're excluded from stuff so much and then I was included in it so much, I actually was quite overwhelmed emotionally. And yeah, I did well up when I saw the pitch for this ad, and it's more or less exactly as the pitch was. I'm talking about Starbucks. The ad is called What's Your Name, and it was produced by the agency Iris.
Carol, you remember my Gemma?
Gemma?
I can relate to being excluded and misunderstood. I can relate to self-editing and all those kind of things, which I do still in my life, you know. And I've seen a lot of very positive responses to this campaign. I have also seen a lot of very negative responses to this campaign. So we mustn't underestimate how brave Starbucks have been in making this stance. And just a little bit of additional information. Starbucks are offering to raise money for Mermaids, which is a charity which supports the transgender community. And it is an amazingly serendipitous coincidence that the logo for Starbucks is a mermaid. And they're selling mermaid logoed cookies in store, and that's where the money from those sales will go to Mermaid. So it's beyond an ad. And in the pitch they talked about using Starbucks as safe spaces for the transgender community and so on and so forth. So let's see how far they take the TV ad into a bigger, longer term inclusion strategy, which is what I hope will actually happen. Dave, as a brand owner, how do you feel about this whole social purpose stuff? Is it something that you'd want the London Sock Company to get involved in? I don't mean specifically LGBTQ stuff, but finding a social purpose for the London Sock Company.
Yeah, no, we right from the outset, we wanted to have a social element to our business. It was just, and we chose to donate socks to homeless people. We found that actually one of the most asked for things at most homeless shelters around the UK is socks.
Wow.
And if you think of the conditions that a lot of people find themselves in, it's not a real surprise. Like, their footwear is doesn't really last long, and they end up with problems. So yeah, we've now, I think that's scaled up to a point. Last year, I think we donated around 12,000 pairs. And in fact, now if you go through our website, we embedded a new bit of technology in the checkout so that every order that people place, we donate a pair of socks, and you can actually choose which charity you want to send the pair to. So you don't even, it's not even just on us. But I think it's got to be down to whether you feel it's important to you as a business. We did. We're still a for-profit business, but we wanted to have a social element. We called it our Pull Your Socks Up campaign. So there's a whole page on our website of all the things that we've done along the way. And I think it's lovely to do. I think it just, your team as well, that when it was just us, we felt good doing it. And now you see the team, like, it gives them just a purpose beyond just building a business and supporting your customer. But the only other thing I would add, I think it's just a really lovely example that look at the good stuff that can come from just speaking to your customers more. I think you look at that's happened with Starbucks and the creativity that's come out of just taking the time to talk to your customers and understand what's going on in their lives. I think that's a really nice lesson for an up-and-coming brand like ours, that actually just spend more time speaking to your customers and just see what they can open your mind up to.
Yes, I think it was interesting to note that in their pitch, Starbucks told us that they had seen so many people from the trans community talking about the one place they felt safe to use their new name was in Starbucks. So it was based on a real insight that lots of trans people, the few places that they could do it was in Starbucks, where they wouldn't be judged and people wouldn't care about it. So based on a real life experience, clearly I think it was going to create a very powerful ad.
And what's your name?
It's James.
There is a bit of an LGBTQ theme today, because the next ad is for British Gas, and the backstory to this one is it's a new brand look and feel for British Gas. Well, tonally it's a new feel, because Wilbur the Penguin is no more. He is an ex-penguin.
I don't know.
I hope he's gone to a nice home for penguins somewhere, but anyway, he's no longer. And
can you just imagine like advertising mascot heaven where they've been retired and they're all
I hope it's not because of global warming either, like that would be a horrible
And yeah, I mean, they use the language a seismic shift in their advertising. I think it's a bit punchy, but they've obviously moved away from animation. It was pretty Ron Seal, I think, their other ads, which was like, it's cold, boiler might break, we're here for you, and there's a penguin delivering that message. Now it's very kind of very human and emotional led. It's based around a gay couple and their life, and actually British Gas play a very small role in it. They're living what appears to be very fun and active and enjoyable life with friends and family and together, and then there's a leak basically, and British Gas come and fix it within seconds. So they play a very small part, which I think is quite brave. But yeah, you can see strategically this is about kind of playing a role in someone's life, having an emotional connection to say, oh yes, like this is my life and British Gas are part of it.
There's a couple of ads in the series. I shared with you the LGBTQ one where there's a gay couple. There's also a mixed race couple.
Okay.
And it's the same kind of slice of life thing, and then something happens and British Gas comes to the rescue. I'll tell you what my pals in the queer community think about it. They love the fact that it shows a kind of dysfunctional gay couple. You know, they have an argument and they don't live in a perfect house, because, you know, we feel we get stereotypicalized, is that a word?
We'll go with it.
Sure.
That is nice.
As, you know, like having kind of cool homes and perfect relationships and all, you know, when advertisers do kind of put us into those kind of things. And it was just like two blokes who were in a loving relationship, which kind of has its ups and downs, dare I say, like my mum and dad would say. Mm. And the bin juice was my favourite part of the ad. Because everybody can identify with that.
In fairness, it was very relatable, yeah.
And Jill Duggan, who's the marketing director of British Gas, kindly reached out and sent me a copy of the ad. So thanks to Jill for doing that. And well done to the AND partnership who made the ad too. So, I mean, I'm only going to say good things about it, and I know you didn't slag it off in front of me anyway. But as consumers, how did you react to it?
Yeah, I liked it. I thought the use of the track was excellent, very recognisable, very noticeable. I think, yeah, maybe the execution will evolve over time in terms of the role that the brand plays, but I can definitely see what the strategy is, and I think the strategy is really smart. I think it makes it more adult, more human, more accessible than a penguin mascot, which I'm sure was helpful in terms of being recognisable, but in terms of it making it feel like it's a brand for you,
a contemporary brand.
I think it's a smart shift.
What are you doing? Oh.
And last but by no means least, a new campaign from Marks & Spencer's, which I only included because it's got my favourite song as the backing track to it.
Excellent use of music.
1977. I was there in a disco listening to this amazing piece of music that I had never heard anything like it before. Giorgio Moroder, the producer, Donna Summer, You kind of freaked out that I know too much about this.
Yeah. No, I didn't even know it was Donna Summer.
Oh, come on. Really?
I wasn't there in 1977.
Okay, all right. I'm not freaked out. Like, that's an amazing track.
I feel like it had a resurgence in the 90s.
It did,
though, right?
Yes, yeah.
I can imagine, yeah.
And I think like it is did. Still the epitome of the disco era, which you know I'm a huge fan of. But as an ad, what do we think?
Yeah, and obviously time will tell with it, but I'd imagine it must be very tough for them with... You know, they're still very reliant on so many older age demographics who were their core customer and probably still are. And, you know, they've been in an environment where they've tried to compete with the likes of Primark and other low cost, fast fashion retailers. So quality has gone down, price has gone down. Is that what young people are looking for from an M&S? Who knows? Mm. I agree with you, the music's great. And it's just, you know, you just watch it without really thinking about it. Yeah. So.
Well, the Marketing Society's CEO Gemma Greaves is leaving to start a new venture. We're sorry to see you go, Gemma. And of course, the Society is hunting for a new CEO, genuinely. So if you fancy being the CEO of the Marketing Society, you know where to send your CV. And Gemma, very kindly, is going to join us on the podcast to tell us, I hope, maybe reveal a bit about what she's going to do next, what it's like leading the UK's marketing community, and as I say, maybe what she's up to next. So looking forward to talking to you, Gemma. I want to say hello to all the students at Bournemouth University because weirdly, Dave, we're going to be on their curriculum.
Brilliant.
As I don't quite sure how this is going to work, but there's an episode coming up where they're going to have to listen and write an essay about it or something. I think something like that is happening, and then the best two are going to come on the podcast and talk about what it's like studying advertising at Bournemouth University. So hello to everybody.
I've never felt so responsible.
So, but hopefully we can do our bit and encourage new talent to kind of come into
It's a great university with a great course. So
sector
great.
Two.
You'll have to do your recording much later in the day just so that give them a chance to get out of bed in time and stuff.
But Dave, thank you very much for joining us. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Dave.
What we haven't said is that Dave has obviously brought us some socks to have a look at. So we'll be unboxing our socks. So thank you very much for those. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
Great. Yeah, thanks, Dave.
See you soon.
Cheers, guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.